I had my choice when I commenced. I bid neither for soft eulogies, big money returns, nor for the approbation of existing schools and conventions. Unstopped and unwarped by any influence outside the soul within me, I've had my say entirely my own way, and put it unerringly on record, the value thereof to be decided by the time. Walt Whitman published his poem Leaves of Grass for the first time in 1855. Whitman is now celebrated as one of the most genuine poets in American literary history, but he did not start out as a poet. In fact, he was a newspaper journalist for 25 years before he published his poem. One might say that his originality in poetry had little to do with the poetic label attached to it. Already in his journalistic writings, Whitman had been slightly different from the discourse of his time. While working for the Aurora newspaper, for instance, he wrote accounts on events which were devoid of facts and filled with descriptions of elicited senses of being there. Such attempts of directory involving the reader into writing were equally present in his editorial on various social matters, like his plea in 1847 against the extension of slavery. Simultaneously, his style of writing cannot be viewed separate from his attempts for unification across the various niches of American society. Such style was characteristic for Whitman's journalistic work, and as he had an unwillingness to impose any artificial structurings upon them. This, according to Fishkin. And such artificial structures were not just missing where journalistic facts were concerned, but they would also be missing in his poetry. As a result, the first comments by the London critic upon publication stressed that Whitman was acquainted with art as a hawk with mathematics. Yet Whitman's aim might not have been primarily stylish. About his work, Democratic Vistas, he wrote to Edward Doden in a letter in 1872. I seek to typify a living human personality, immensely animal, with immense passions, immense emotiveness, immense adhesiveness, in woman immense maternity, and then in both immenser, far a moral conscious, and in always realizing the direct and the indirect control of the divine laws through all and over all. More than his style in poetry, Whitman was attacked for what seemed to be bold physical presence in his poems. Here the drama between absence and presence evolves to the fullest extent. The presence of the individual body, in his case Walt, is self-evident, only insofar as it can be categorized as self-evident. As soon as these categories are questioned, however, new bodies are moved and accentuated. Individual voices at first, individual hearers later, but never authorless, for there is always someone present, whether imaginary or otherwise, as truly it must be said that linguistics to the imaginary or metaphysical, and who could ever proclaim that silence has no effect, as Whitman wrote. Backward, I see my own days where I sweated through the fog with linguistics and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. And the reception of his work thereon was marked by the process of separating the person from his sexuality, an old but persistent operation of physical fragmentation. Reduction and overestimation of some body parts, excluding through the process all other expression of individualism. After all the work which Whitman wrote, his sexual presence seemed to be the main focus of attention. This should not pose as a surprise, of course, between the restraint of intellectualism and the expressive quality of poetry. Western rational tradition would not have it any other way. Sexuality is the main motive to rationalize otherwise ungraspable emotion. Some lines seem to shock and reveal everything, and certainly lines from Leaves of Grass, like, copulation is no more rank to me than death is, and wind whose saw thickling genitals rub against me, it shall be you. It must have caught the eye of the beholder immediately, so why bother to listen to anything else he poeted? Why bother to view his lines expressing his sarcasm on categories of demonstration? Hooray for positive signs! Long live exact demonstration! Fetch stone crop and mix it with cedar and branches of lilac. This is the lexicographer or chemist. This made a grammar of the old cartouches. And continuing to restore life, energy, and movement. Gentlemen, I receive you and attach in clasp hands with you. The facts are useful and real. They are not my dwelling. I enter by them to an area of the dwelling. I am less the reminder of property and qualities and more the reminder of life. And go on the square for my own sake and for others' sake and make short account of neuters and geldings and favor men and women fully equipped. And beat the gong of refold and stop with fugitives and them that plot and conspire. It is time to wonder if, underlying the sheer construction of creativity, counterculture, politics, intellectualism, science, and sexuality, there is another, rather painful result which is not exclusive to the 19th century critiques, nor of the 20th century complaints. Much more, we are today burdened with a construction of passivity and activity which might have been the contrary disposition underlying the entire process all along. And I wonder how penetrating this disposition has been in your own view of culture. Let's for a moment disperse with all traditional categories of gender, intellectualism, and sexuality, and concentrate on this passivity-activity disposition. Better yet, let's look at the politicization of the disposition through a practical example of the reception of Whitman's work. Two biographic accounts, Whitman's life, have been blown up to the fullest extent of the rationality operation. The first event concerned his contact with Anne Gilchrist, an English woman who had a passionate love for Whitman's work, and felt both were soulmates in the truest sense of the word. The other event concerned Whitman's contact with John Addington Symonds, who had an equal passion for Whitman's work and firmly believed Whitman to be a homosexual. Whitman had a somewhat restrained reaction towards both. Such reaction could have been motivated by a number of reasons, two numbers here even to attempt to account for, but history has a tendency to prefer one interpretation over the other, For instance, Whitman answered one of Anne Gilchrist's letters as followed. Washington, November 3, 1871. Dear friend, I have been waiting quite a long while for time and the right mood to answer your letter in a spirit as serious as its own, and in the same unmitigated trust and affection. But I must at least show, without further delay, that I am not insensible to your love. I too send you my love. And do you feel no disappointment because I know, write but briefly? My book is the best letter, my response, my truest explanation of all. In it I have put my body and spirit. You understand this better, fuller, clearer than anyone else. And I too fully and clearly understand the loving and womanly letter it has evoked. Enough that there surely exists between us so beautiful and delicate a relation, accepted by both of us with joy. But when she proposed to come to the United States, he advised her not to do that. In general, explanations about Whitman's reaction resemble the one written by Haviland Miller. The poet who shocked the world because of his anatomical candor, and who boldly summoned lovers to embrace him wherever he walked, did not know how to handle a woman whose ardor his verses had inflamed. She exposed her feelings without shame and without stint. He was awed by her emotional excesses, perhaps frightened. He retreated and she pursued. She wanted to come to America. He preferred to have an ocean between them. Whitman's reaction to Anne Gilchrist was less outspoken than his reaction towards John Edington Symonds. When Symonds referred to those parts concerning Leaves of Grass which supposedly revealed approval of homosexual relationships, Whitman's reaction was much stronger. According to Roger Edmondson, Whitman's reply was an emphatic denial of any homosexual content in his poetry. About the questions of the columnist's pieces, they quite daze me that the columnist's part has even allowed the possibility of such a construction as mentioned is terrible. I am vain to hope the pages themselves are not even mentioned for such gratuitous and entirely undreamed possibility of morbid inferences which are disavowed by me and seem damnable. This from a fragment of Whitman's letter to Edington. Strangely enough, his reaction with Symonds is viewed as a denial of homosexuality, while his reaction to Anne Gilchrist is viewed as a rejection of an over-emotional reaction by a woman. Where the man is concerned, the relation becomes part of a denial or embrace of self-reflection. Where the woman is concerned, her emotional imagination is highlighted. To put it bluntly, Symonds was right in expecting a homosexual admittance. Probably on the part of Whitman. Gilchrist was wrong in expecting any emotional reaction from the poet. The fact that both were denied such response, anything obviously fiercer than Gilchrist, seems to be less important in Whitman's qualification as a homosexual by a general audience. In the vast amounts of interpretation that followed Whitman's work, many interpretations have highlighted his urge for democracy, his agony with the Civil War, his poetry as a journalistic invention, his poetry as an alteration of English and American poetic tradition, or as absolutely genuine, or as sexual, and narcissistic. Even without renouncing the quality of these interpretations, one could very well say that they all depend on the various citations selected from the poems. And indeed, a poem which contains 400 different subtitles is open to an interpretation of any kind, as was its purpose to begin with. Whitman's sensitivity towards the multiplication of life, as expressed in his poems, nevertheless has received very little attention. The fact that he shielded himself in public but proclaimed himself in poetry could, on the one hand, be accounted for by the cultural context, the body control of his time, as he too, conforming to the Protestant tradition, restrained himself and urged others to restrain themselves as well. Or, as Haviland wrote, Whitman was more self-disciplined than he superficially seemed, and he venerated, as he advised John Addington Symonds in his famous letter, restraint. As he said to Buick, nature has not only endowed me with immense emotionality, but immense bufferism, so to call it, or placid resignation to what happens, which is as perceptive a comment as anybody has ever ventured in dealing with the complexity of a keenly self-aware man. On the other hand, this keenly self-aware man probably had an equal understanding and motivated urge to include everybody in the process of sensitivity. And, as we know by now, such process does not allow for politicalization, in which women are to remain passive and men are allowed to be active. I am afraid we must conclude that the passivity-activity disposition relies more on gossip, and as a matter of irony, so does the social-scientific narrative, as soon as it contradicts the poetic expression in terms of rationality. Dennis Tetlock once wrote that poetry can be viewed as an oral history, at least in anthropology. His experiments with poetry from Zuni language left a great impression upon the scholars of our time. Nevertheless, a poetry movement of such kind, taking up its definite place in anthropology, never has truly been taken serious. Poetry remains the in-between on which the scientific interpretation is released. Maybe this is rightly so, for Whitman neither wanted to divine or classify poetry, as this would surely mean its destruction of openness. But the interplay between absence and presence has allowed science to get rid of the poet, and not to take into account that for the poet, presence is the main essence of writing, the poem in the first place, as Whitman explicitly expressed in 1891. Leaves of grass, indeed, I cannot too often reiterate, has mainly been the outcropping of my own emotional and other personal nature, an attempt, from the first to the last, to put, see, a person, a human being, myself, the latter half of the 19th century in America, freely, fully, and truly on record. I could not find any similar personal record in current literature that satisfied me. And damn those who overlook this matter for purposes of rational science or for the purpose of political justification. Indeed, it almost seems that through the vitalization of poetry, the general idea of the perfect individual is realized, more often than the presence of the poet is recognized. By now, Whitman has almost become the true physical species of the American homosexual white male.